hide and close the door. Lula and I scurried to a window on the side of the house where curtains hadn't been drawn and looked in at Joyce and the Jeep guy. The two of them were examining the beaver, patting it on the head, smiling at it. "Think they've had a few drinky-poos," Lula said. "Anyone in their right mind wouldn't bring the beaver from hell into their house." After a minute or two, Joyce and the Jeep guy got tired of the beaver and... I waited until they were a safe distance, and then I pushed the bang button. There was a moment's lag, and then blam! Beaver fur and beaver stuffing as far as the eye could see. The fur and glop hung from couches, chairs, tables, and table lamps. It was in Joyce's hair and was stuck to the back of her shirt. Joyce froze for a beat, turned and looked around with her eyes bugged out.
"Fuck!" Joyce shrieked. "Fuck, fuck, fuck!"
"Holy crap," Lula said. We sprang from the window and ran through the neighbor's yard to where we'd parked the car. We jumped into it, and I laid rubber out of there. "Guess it wasn't a singing beaver after all," I said.
"Yeah, darn," Lula said. "I was looking forward to hearing some singing."
I was smiling so wide my cheeks ached. It was worth my last $8.
"That was awesome," Lula said. "That Coughlin is a freaking genius."
Lula had her Firebird parked in the small lot behind my office. She got off at her car and motored home to my apartment. Morelli was watching television when I came in.
"You look happy," he said. "You must have had a productive day."
"It started off slow, but it ended okay."
"There's a casserole in the refrigerator. It's from my mom. It has vegetables in it and everything. And I could use another beer. The game's coming on."
Hours later, we were still in front of the television, and Morelli's cell phone rang.
"I'm not answering it," Morelli said. "The guy who invented the cell phone should rot in hell."
The ringing stopped, and a minute later, it started again. Morelli shut the phone off. We had 3 minutes of silence, and my phone rang in the kitchen.
"Persistent bastard," Morelli said.
The ringing didn't stop, and finally Morelli went to the kitchen and answered the phone. He was smiling when he came back. "Good news?" I asked.
"Yes, but I'm gonna have to go to work."
"The Behringer case?"
"No, something else."
He went to the bedroom, rousted Bob off the bed, and snapped the leash on him.
"I might have to go under for a while, but I'll call," Morelli said. "And don't worry about Dickie. I'm sure it'll work out okay."
He grabbed his jacket and kissed me.
"Later."
I closed and locked the door after him and stood for a moment, taking the pulse of the apartment. It felt empty without Morelli. On the other hand, I could watch something sappy on television, wear my ratty, comfy flannel jammies, and hog the bed. Chapter 6. I got up late because there was no real good reason to get up early. I made coffee and ate chunky cereal out of the box and pushed it down with a banana. My files were spread across the dining room table. Coughlin, Diggory, and a third file I hadn't yet opened. Today was the day for the third file. I had the file in my hand, and my phone rang.
"Are you all right?" my mother asked.
"Couldn't be better."
"Have you seen the paper this morning?"
"No."
"Don't look," she said.
"Now what?"
"It's all over the news that you killed Dickie."
"Tell her I'll visit her in the big house," Grandma yelled at my mother. "Tell her I'll bring her cigarettes so she can pay off the butch guards."
"I'll call you back," I said to my mother. I disconnected and looked out my peephole. Good deal. Mr. Molinowski's morning paper was still lying in front of his door. I tiptoed out, snatched it up, and scurried back into my apartment. The headline read, "Local Bounty Hunter Prime Suspect in Ore Disappearance." Front page. And the article was accompanied by an unflattering picture of me taken while I was waiting for Goebel in the municipal building lobby. They'd interviewed Joyce, and Joyce was quoted as saying I'd always been jealous of her and had fits of violent behavior even as a child. There was a mention of the time Grandma and I accidentally burned down the funeral home. And there was a second file photo of me with no eyebrows, the result of my car exploding into a fireball a while back. And then there were several statements by secretaries who witnessed me going postal on Dickie. One of the secretaries stated that I had pointed a gun at Dickie and threatened to put a big hole in his head.
"That was Lula," I said to the empty hall.
I put the paper back on Mr. Molinowski's welcome mat, returned to my apartment, threw the bolt on the door, and called my mother.
"All a pack of lies," I said to my mother. "Ignore it. Everything's fine.
I went downtown to have coffee with Marty Goebel, and someone got the wrong idea. There was a pause while my mother talked herself into halfway believing. I'm having a roast chicken tonight. Are you and Joseph coming to dinner? It was Friday night. Morelli and I always had dinner at my parents' house on Friday night. Sure, I said. I'll be there. I don't know about Joe. He's on a case. I drank coffee and read the third file. Stuart Hansen was charged with running a light and possession of a controlled substance. He was 22 years old, unemployed, and he lived in a house on Myrtle Street at the back end of the burg. The house had been posted as collateral on the bond. It was owned by Stuart's cousin, Trevor. I heard a sharp rap on my door and went to look out the security peephole. It was Joyce.
Open this door, she yelled. I know you're in there.
She tried to rattle the door, but it held tight.
What do you want? I called through the door.
I want to talk to you.
About what?
About Dickie, you moron. I want to know where he is. You found out about the money and you somehow managed to snatch him, didn't you?
Why do you want to know where he is?
None of your business. I just need to know, Joyce said.
What's with the knit hat on your head? I asked her. I almost didn't recognize you. You never wear a hat.
Joyce fidgeted with a hat.
It's cold out. Everyone wears a hat in this weather.
Especially everyone who has beaver fur stuck to their hair.
So where the frig is he? Joyce asked.
I told you, I don't know. I didn't kill him. I didn't kidnap him. I have no clue where he is.
Great, Joyce said. That's how you want to play it? Okay, by me.
And she stomped away.
What's wrong with this picture? I asked Rex. How did this happen?
Rex was asleep in his soup can. Hard to have a meaningful conversation with a hamster in a can. I thought with the way my morning was running, it wouldn't hurt to have Lula along when I went to see Stuart. Lula wasn't much good as an apprehension agent, but she understood the need for a donut when a takedown went into the toilet.
So what did this guy do?
Lula was in the passenger seat of Ranger's Cayenne looking through Stuart Hansen's file.
It just says controlled substance here. Who wrote this? It don't tell you anything.
I turned onto Myrtle and drove by the house. It looked benign. Small cottage, small plot of land. Indistinguishable from every other house on the street. Christmas lights still up outlining the front door, not lit. I circled the block and parked one house down. Lula and I got out and walked up to Stuart Hansen's house.
This house is closed up tight, Lula said. It got blackout drapes on all the windows. Either they're trying to conserve energy or else they're running around naked in there.
I had new cuffs and a stun gun from Connie. Easier to stun gun someone when he's naked.
Yeah, you got a lot to choose from. You ready to do this?
I gave her a thumbs up and she hauled out her gun and jogged around the house to secure the back door. I felt comfortable she wouldn't have to shoot anyone, because Lula, holding her big Glock, dressed in her Sasquatch boots, poison green tights, and matching spandex miniskirt, topped off with shocking pink rabbit fur jacket, was enough to make a strong man faint. I had my cell phone on speaker clipped to my jacket, the line open. Are you in place? I asked Lula.
You betcha,
Lula said from the back of the house. I rapped on the front door with my 2-pound maglite. No one answered, so I rapped again, and I yelled, Bond enforcement!
Shit, Lula said on speakerphone. Turn your head when you do that. You just about busted my eardrum.
I'm going in, I told her.
Don't exert yourself breaking a door down. The back is open.
I heard a gunshot and had a moment of panic.
Oops, Lula said. Ignore that.
The front door was locked, so I waited for Lula to open the door for me. She was smiling wide when she let me in.
You're not going to believe this, she said. We hit the jackpot on this one. We must have died and gone to heaven and no one told us.
I stepped into a small foyer constructed of raw wallboard. A door opened off the foyer, and beyond the door was cannabis. The house was a pot farm. Grow lights, silver reflective walls, fans and vents, and racks and more racks of shelves filled with plants in various stages of growth.
Wait until you see the dining room, Lula said. They got primo shit growing in the dining room.
I gave her a raised eyebrow.
Not that I would know, Lula said.
There's weed sticking out of the pockets on your jacket.
I gathered some evidence on my way through the house.
I assume you didn't see any Hansons?
No, but there's a car back there, and the back door to the house was open. I wouldn't be surprised that someone hadn't in here.
Do we have to worry about them getting away in the car?
No. Someone shot a hole in the right front tire.
I locked and bolted the front door, and Lula and I began working our way through the house.
You go first and open the doors, and I'll be behind you with my gun, Lula said. I'd go first, but it's hard to hold a gun and open a door. I want to be able to concentrate on the gun. It's not like I'm afraid or anything.
Just don't shoot me in the back.
Have I ever shot you? Honest to goodness, you'd think I didn't know what I was doing.
We searched the living room, dining room, and kitchen.
At least these boys are neat, Lula said. They got their empty beer bottles all lined up. Guess that's so they have room in here for planting the little seedlings and weighing and bagging. And they got a nice digital scale here. You can see they put some thought to this.
I poked around in the collection of pots and pans and bottles and jars by the stove. Looks like they have a science experiment going on. Alcohol, coffee filters, ether.
These guys are nuts, Lula said. They're making hash oil. You could turn yourself into a barbecue making that stuff.
We moved down the hall to the bedrooms. No need to search under beds because there weren't any. Two sleeping bags were thrown against a wall in one of the bedrooms. A television sat on the floor. The closet was filled with clothes. The rest of the room was cannabis.
This is kind of cozy, Lula said. I bet it's like sleeping in the jungle.
We checked out the bathroom in the second bedroom. Lots of weed drying out in the second bedroom, but no Hansons. We're missing something, I said to Lula, going back to the kitchen.
We opened every door, Lula said. We looked around all the racks. We looked behind the shower curtain, and we moved the clothes all around in the closet. There's no cellar and no garage and no attic.
There's a cup of coffee sitting on the counter, and the coffee is still warm. Someone was in here, and I don't think they had time to leave. You were at the back door, and I was at the front door. We checked the windows. No one went out through a window. Lula cut her eyes to the cupboard over the counter.
Maybe he left just before we got here. You know, lucky coincidence for him.
Yeah, I said, cuffs in one hand, stun gun in the other, attention focused on the cupboard. That could be it. Lula stepped back and two-handed the Glock, aiming it at the cupboard. I reached up and opened one of the doors, and Stuart Hansen tumbled out, crashing onto the counter, sending the science experiment flying. He flopped off the counter onto the floor and scrambled like a cat on black ice, legs moving but no intelligent forward motion. In the excitement of the moment, Lula squeezed off a shot that went wide of Hansen but knocked out the ether bottle. The liquid splashed onto the gas stove, and we were all paralyzed for a moment.
Pilot light, Hansen said.
We all dove for the back door, and I think I was in the air when the explosion occurred. Or maybe it was the explosion that threw me out of the house.
Holy crap, Hansen said.
He was on the ground next to me, and Lula was on her back, skirt up to her neck, next to him.
Who shot that bottle? Lula said. It wasn't me, was it?
I clapped the cuffs on Hansen, and we all took a bunch of steps backward. Anyone else in the house? I asked Hansen.
No, I was alone.
We watched the fire rush through the house. It was like a brush fire, and almost instantly the whole house was burning, and clouds of pot smoke were billowing out over the berg. Sirens were screaming in the distance, and the three of us leaned against Hansen's car and sucked it all in while tiny pieces of cannabis ash sifted down around us.
This is good shit,
Hansen said, taking a deep breath.
Smells like you had some Hawaii 5-0, Lula said. Not that I'd know.
I looked down to make sure my toes weren't smoking. Maybe we should move back a little. We all scurried to Hansen's rear boundary.
This is pretty funny, Lula said. We burned down a house.
And Lula started laughing. Hansen was laughing too.
Probably $1 million worth of grass in that house, Hansen said. Up in smoke.
I was laughing so hard I tipped over and found myself on the ground.
Look at me, I said. I can make snow angels.
I'm getting wet, Lula said. Is it raining?
Sounds carried from the front of the house. The rumble of the fire truck engines and the crackle and squawk of police band radios.
I'm so fucking hungry, Lula said. I need chips. I'd fucking kill for chips.
A black SUV slid to a stop behind Hansen's car. Tank left the car and walked toward us.
I've got her, he said into his walkie. She's in the back with Lula.
Ranger's Cayenne pulled in behind the SUV. Ranger got out, scooped me up off the ground, and held me close.
I was afraid you were in the house, Ranger said. Are you all right?
I got blown out of it, I told him. And then it started raining.
It's not rain. It's from the fire hoses on the other side of the house.
He pulled back a little and looked at me.
Babe, you're high as a kite.
Yes, and you are so cute.
Ranger put me in the Cayenne and handed Stuart and Lula over to Tank. We drove the length of the alley and turned onto Chambersburg Street.
You're always so quiet, I said to Ranger. What's with that?
Ranger didn't move, but I suspected he was rolling his eyes.
Well, I said.
I like quiet.
Quiet, 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 I said,
and I gave Ranger a shot to the arm.
Don't do that, Ranger said.
I gave him another shot. Ranger pulled to the curb and cuffed me to the sissy bar over the passenger side window.
Are you going to have your way with me now that I'm handcuffed? I asked.
Would you like that?
Absolutely not.
Ranger smiled, put the Cayenne in gear, and pulled away from the curb.
I saw that smile, I said.
On the one hand, I was feeling very flirty and clever. On the other hand, in a dark back corner of my mind, I suspected I was one of those people who gets obnoxious on wacky tobacco. No matter which was right, I couldn't seem to stop.
So, I said, knowing I was pressing the issue, don't you want to have your way with me?
More than you could possibly imagine, but right now you're wet and you smell like pot. You're lucky I let you in my car.
Where are we going?
I'm taking you home so you can take a hot shower and get dressed in dry clothes.
And then?
We'll see. Oh, boy.
Ranger was in the kitchen making a sandwich when I straggled in. I'd steamed myself in the shower until the water ran cold, and then I'd slipped into jeans and a t-shirt, letting my hair dry on its own. He looked over at me.
How are you feeling?
Hungry and tired.
You had a full morning. You burned a house down to the ground.
I took two slices of bread, slathered them with mustard, and added ham and cheese. Technically, Lula started the fire. It was an accident. She winged a bottle of ether and it spilled onto the gas stove.
We're holding the kid in the cuffs. What do you want to do with him?
He's FTA. I need to turn him in.
If you turn him in, you're going to be implicated in the fire. It's going to get you more publicity.
I need the money.
Ranger got a bottle of water from the fridge.
I can give you a job if you need money.
What would I do?
Fill my minority quota for one thing. I only employ one woman, and she's my housekeeper.
Besides that?
Odd jobs, Ranger said. You can work part-time on an as-needed basis.
Do you need me now?
Ranger smiled.
You missed your chance, I told him.
I'll get another one. You got a phone call while you were in the shower and he left a message. You should listen to it.
The message was from Peter Smullen. He wanted to speak to me. Would I please call him back? Ranger was leaning against the counter, arms crossed, watching me.
Hard to believe my day could get any worse, I said to him.
You underestimate yourself.
I dialed Smullen and waded through layers of secretaries. Finally, Smullen came on.
I appreciate the call back, he said. I imagine your days are complicated since Dickie's disappearance.
It's been interesting.
I was hoping we could get together for a chat.
What do you want to chat about? I asked him.
Things.
That narrows it down.
I prefer not to discuss sensitive issues on the phone. I have a full schedule this afternoon, but I was hoping we might meet for a drink after hours. Perhaps the bar at the Marriott at 8?
Sure. See you at 8.
I have a date, I said to Ranger. It turns out I'm very in demand. Everyone wants to talk to me. The police, Joyce, Peter Smullen.
Did Smullen say why he wanted to meet with you?
He said he wanted to talk about things.
Like maybe the fact that I planted a bug on him.
And Joyce?
She was here this morning demanding to know where I stashed Dickie.
As in chopped up body parts you fed to your neighbor's cat or alive and living in your closet?
I don't know.
You should find out. Maybe she knows something we don't.
Maybe you should talk to her, I said to Ranger. She likes you.
You throw me into the shark tank?
That got me smiling.
Is Big Bad Ranger afraid of Joyce Barnhart?
I'd rather face the python.
Joyce doesn't have a long attention span. I'm surprised she's still involved in this. Ranger's phone buzzed, and he answered it on speaker mode.
You have a meeting on the calendar for 1 o'clock, Tank said. Do you need a ride?
Yes.
I'm in the lot. I'll be right down.
Ranger took the Cayenne keys from his pocket and placed them on the counter. He counted out $400 and placed that on the counter as well.
Caesar is designing a system for a new client tomorrow morning, and a female point of view would be helpful. He'll pick you up at 9. I'll send a uniform with him. The money is an advance on salary for services you'll provide.
He backed me against the wall, leaned into me, and kissed me. His tongue touched mine, and I felt my fingers involuntarily curl into his shirt, and heat rushed through my stomach and headed south. He broke from the kiss and looked down at me with a suggestion of a smile, just a slight curve to the corners of his mouth.
"That's an advance on services I provide," he said.
He grabbed his jacket and left. Chapter 7. Since I was no longer desperate for money, I decided to spend the afternoon on activities designed to keep me out of jail. I heard what Morelli was saying, that Dickie was just a missing person and I shouldn't worry. But people had been sent to jail for less. I knew this for a fact. I helped put them there. First up was a conversation with Joyce. I drove to her house and parked in her driveway behind a ProServe van and hatchback. Joyce's front door was open, and I could see a cleaning crew working inside. A couch and chair had been set curbside, terminal victims of the Beaver explosion. I picked out a guy who looked like he might speak English and asked for Joyce.
"Not here," he said. "She let us in and split."
"That's okay. I'll just look around until she gets back. I'm her interior decorator. We had an appointment, but I'm early."
"Sure," he said. "Knock yourself out."
The house was elaborately decorated with a lot of velvet upholstery and gilt-framed mirrors. Rugs were plush. Marble in the kitchen and bathroom, satin in the bedroom, flat-screen televisions everywhere. Joyce had married well this last time around. She chose a more velvet and gilt than I could manage, but it looked expensive. There was a designated office library, the shelves filled with hardcover books that probably had belonged to her ex. A large carved mahogany desk floated in the middle of the room. The desktop was clean. Telephone, but no scribble pad, no computer. I checked all the drawers. Telephone book, nothing else. I returned to the kitchen and sat at the little built-in workstation. The phone was attached to an answering machine. A Starbucks coffee mug held pens and markers. A couple sticky pads were stacked next to the phone. I opened the top drawer and found a piece of paper with 2 9-digit numbers and a phone number scrawled on it. I recognized one as Dickie's social security number. Odd how you remember things like that. I didn't recognize the second number or the phone number. I dialed the phone number and a programmed voice introduced itself as the Smith Barney Automated Reserved Client Service Center and asked for an account number. That was as far as I was going to get, so I copied the 3 numbers on a sticky pad and put the paper in my pocket. I didn't see anything else of interest on Joyce's desk. I scrolled through calls made and calls received on her phone and copied the list going back 4 days. I packed up and ran into Joyce as I was leaving the kitchen.
"What the fuck?" Joyce said.
"I was looking for you," I told her.
"Well, you found me. What do you want?"
"I thought if we put our heads together, we might be able to figure out what happened to Dickie."
"I know what happened to him. I just don't know where he is now."
"Why do you care?" I asked Joyce.
"I love him."
I burst out laughing, and Joyce cracked a smile.
"Okay, even I couldn't keep a straight face on that one," Joyce said.
"Do you think he's dead?"
"Hard to say until a body turns up one way or another. What I can tell you is this, stay out of my way. I've got an investment here and I intend to collect, and I'll run over anyone who tries to stop me."
Hard to believe Dickie had that much money. From what I could see, he wasn't that smart.
"You have no idea what's involved here, and I'm warning you again, stay out of it."
Joyce was really starting to annoy me. Bad enough from time to time Morelli and Ranger tried to push me around, now Joyce was telling me to butt out. "Looks like you're doing some redecorating," I said to Joyce. "Is that animal fur on your chandelier?" We locked eyes, and I knew the thought was fluttering in her head. Did Stephanie Plum mastermind the Beaver bombing? And then the moment passed, and we both stepped back from it. I walked to the Cayenne, got in, and powered out of the driveway. I drove to Coughlin's house, just for the heck of it, and saw that the green SUV was parked in the alley, 2 tires on Coughlin's property line. I angle-parked behind the SUV, blocking its exit, and I approached Coughlin's back door with stun gun in hand. Coughlin answered the door with a sawed-off shotgun in his.
"Now what?"
he asked. "Same old, I told him.
I'm not going with you. I can't. I gotta stay here. I'll go as soon as I can.
I looked down the barrel of the sawed-off.
All right, then, I said. Good conversation. Call me when you're ready to, you know.
I got into the Cayenne and took off for the bond's office.
If you're looking for Lula, she isn't here, Connie said when I walked in. She went home to get dry clothes and never came back. Sounds like you had a busy morning. I hear people are driving from all over the state to breathe Berg air.
I swear I didn't have anything to do with that fire. I wasn't anywhere near that house.
Sure, Connie said. Did you get Hansen?
Yes and no. I came here to use the buy phone number program.
Is this for Hansen?
No. I'm trying to make sense of the Dickey mess. Joyce is tied up in it. I don't exactly know how or why, but I got some numbers off her phone and I want to run them down. One of them is a Smith Barney Automated Reserve Client Service Center.
That's heavy, Connie said. Reserve clients are those with at least 10 million in assets. What else do you have on that list?
I pulled a chair up to Connie's desk and gave her the list. The three numbers on the sticky page came from a piece of paper in Joyce's desk. The rest came from her phone.
Doing some breaking and entering?
Only entering. Her door was open. I'd like to get into that account, but it asked for an account number. Connie looked at the sticky page.
Joyce isn't smart. If she had to write the phone number down, I'm guessing the rest of the information is there, too.
The top number is the phone number. The second number I don't recognize, and the last number is Dickie's social security number.
And they were written in this order on her pad?
Yep. Connie punched the Smith Barney phone number in. The automated voice asked for the account number, and Connie gave it the second 9-digit number. The voice asked for the access code, and Connie punched in the social security number. Access denied. Connie went through the routine again and gave it just the last 4 digits of the social security number.
I'm in, Connie said. There's a zero balance, and the last transaction was a $40 million withdrawal. That was 2 weeks ago.
Connie hung up and looked at me.
That's a shitload of money. Whose account is this?
I don't know.
It can't be Joyce's, Connie said. She'd be in the Bahamas buying men and goats. The access code is from Dickie's social security number, so the logical assumption would be that it's Dickie's account. But I don't know how Dickie would get that kind of money. That's a lot of billable hours.
No kidding. When Joyce said Dickie was worth money, I wasn't thinking this kind of money.
Maybe he stole it from the guys who snatched him and they got cranky.
Connie took the list of numbers I'd lifted from the phone, typed them into her computer, and plugged them into the buy phone number program.
After we get rid of the dupes, there are 16 numbers, Connie said. I'll run them and print them out for you.
I watched the information come in. 5 calls from the law firm in the last 2 days, and Joyce got an incoming call at 1 in the morning from Peter Smullen right after Dickie disappeared.
Isn't Smullen a partner? Connie asked.
Yes. That's kind of weird that he called Joyce at 1 in the morning.
Maybe there's something going on with them.
Yuck. What would that mean for my meeting? I thought Smullen wanted to talk to me about kidnapping and murder. It would be horrible if it turned out he wanted to talk about sex. Maybe he didn't notice the bug. Maybe he noticed the cleavage. The rest of the list looked benign. I took the printed copy from Connie and shoved it into my bag.
Gotta go, I said to Connie.
Connie reached into her top drawer, took out a box of rounds from my Smith & Wesson, and tossed them to me.
Just in case.
I left the bond's office, settled myself in the Cayenne, and called Ranger.
Yo, Ranger said.
I took your advice and went to talk to Joyce, and I learned there's a Smith Barney account that has Dickie's social security number as an access code. It has a zero balance, and the last withdrawal was $40 million.
Joyce shared that with you?
More or less. When you went through Dickie's house, did you search his home office?
No, I wanted to see the crime scene and I didn't have time for much else. I slid in between police investigations.
Maybe it would be a good idea to poke around in Dickie's office and see what turns up. I'd like to prowl through his law office too, but that feels more complicated.
Where are you now?
I'm at the bond's office.
Pick me up at Rangeman.
Rangeman is located on a quiet side street in downtown Trenton. It's a relatively small, unobtrusive 7-story building sandwiched between other commercial properties. There's a number on the front door and a small brass plaque, but no sign announcing Rangeman. Parking is underground in a gated garage. Ranger's private apartment is located on the top floor. The whole operation is very high-tech and secure. Ranger was waiting outside for me. I pulled to the curb and placed his hat on the console. He got in and put the hat on. "Do you feel better now?" I asked him.
"A friend gave this hat to me just before he died. It's a reminder to stay alert."
I glanced over at him. "I thought you wore it because it looked hot." That got a smile from him.
"Do you think I look hot in this hat?"
I thought he looked hot in everything. "It's a pretty good hat," I told him. When I reached Dickie's house, I did a slow drive-by. The crime scene tape had been taken down, and the house no longer felt ominous. No cars in the driveway, no lights shining from windows.
"Park in front of the house," Ranger said. "We're going in like we belong here."
We walked to the door, and Ranger tried the handle. Locked. He took a small tool from his jacket pocket, and in 20 seconds, the door was open. I suspected the tool was for show, and if I hadn't been watching, he'd say abracadabra, and the door would unlock. I followed Ranger in, and the ominous feeling returned. There were still bloodstains on the floor, and the house had been tossed. "Did it look like this when you were here?" I asked.
"No. Someone's been here looking for something, and they weren't subtle."
We went room by room, not disturbing the mess that had been made. Drawers were open, contents thrown on the floor. Cushions were on the floor, and in some cases, slashed. Mattresses ditto. His office was more orderly only because it had clearly been carefully picked over. His computer was missing. His files were also missing. No way to know if they'd been taken by the police or by whoever ransacked the house. All messages on the answering machine were from Joyce.
"Time's up," Ranger said. "We need to get out of here."
We left the same way we came in. Ranger slid behind the wheel of the Cayenne, and we drove away. I checked my watch and realized I was due for dinner at my parents'. I reached Morelli on his cell. "It's Friday," I said.
"And?"
"Dinner?"
"Oh, crap," Morelli said. "I forgot. I can't make it. I'm tied up here."
I didn't say anything. I just sat on the phone.
"It's my job," Morelli said. "You can't get mad at me for doing my job."
And that was true, but I didn't want to go to dinner without Morelli. I was afraid I'd get relentlessly grilled about Dickie if I didn't have Morelli on board to distract my mother and grandmother. "Is that Bob barking?"
"Yeah, Bob's with me."
"So what kind of job is this?"
"It's a secret job."
"And when is this secret job gonna be done?"
"I don't know. Hopefully soon."
"I could swear I hear television."
"Bob's watching a movie."
I hung up and looked at Ranger.
"No,"
Ranger said. "You don't even know what I was going to ask."
"You were going to ask me to fill in for Morelli at dinner."
"Roast chicken."
"You'll have to come up with something better than roast chicken."
"Do you have dinner plans?"
"Are you going to nag me on this?"
"Yes."
"What happened to the Stephanie who thought I was mysterious and scary?"
"Gone." Actually, that wasn't entirely true. Ranger was still mysterious and scary at times. Just not today. Just not compared to my mother and grandmother. Ranger parked in the driveway behind my father's Buick.
"We need to be out of here at 7:30. If you tell Tank I did this, I'll chain you naked to the traffic light on Hamilton and Broad. And I'll shoot your grandmother if she grabs me."
I was pretty sure he was kidding about the traffic light.
"Isn't this something?" Grandma said when she saw Ranger. "What a nice surprise! Is Joe coming too?"
"Nope," I said. "Just Ranger."
"Look here," Grandma called to my mother. "Stephanie swapped out Joseph tonight."
My mother stuck her head out the kitchen door. "Where's Joseph?"
"Working,"
I told her.
"I'm just spooning out the gravy," my mother said. "Everyone sit down."
The doorbell rang and Grandma ran to get it.
"It's him," she said to me. "It's my honey."
My father got out of his chair in the living room and took a seat at the table.
"I don't care if he craps in a bag,"
he said to Ranger.
"I'll give you $100 if you can scare him into marrying her and moving her into his room at the old people's home."
"They won't take him back," I said to my father. "He started a fire and they kicked him out."
"Guess I look like I could still scare somebody," Ranger said to me. "You look like you could scare anybody,"
my father said to him.
"Don't you ever wear anything but black." "Sometimes white socks," Ranger said.
Ranger was smiling a little, and I was thinking he was getting into it, starting to enjoy himself.
"This is my honey, Elmer," Grandma said to everyone.
Elmer was dressed for the occasion in red plaid slacks and a white turtleneck that shoved his loose neck skin up so that it spilled over the top and looked like a turkey gobble.
Howdy doody, Elmer said. You have a peach of a home here, and just look at all these hot women I'm gonna get to have dinner with.
Cripes, my father said.
My mother put the gravy boat on the table and poured herself a glass of wine.
Elmer's taking me to the Benchley viewing tonight, Grandma said, taking her seat. It's gonna be a beaut.
Elmer sat next to Grandma.
I read it was pancreatic cancer that got him. He was a young guy, too. 78.
Elmer reached for the potatoes, and his toupee slid over his ear. The small smile hovered at the corners of Ranger's mouth. We were passing the chicken, gravy, mashed potatoes, green beans, cranberry sauce, dinner rolls, and pickled vegetable dish, and the doorbell chimed. Before anyone could get out of their chair, the door opened and closed, and Joyce Barnhart swept into the house. Her red hair was cut super short and spiked out punk style. Her eyes were lined in black, shadowed in metallic gray. Her lips were inflated to maximum capacity, and her lips and nails were the colors of my mother's wine. Joyce removed her leather duster, revealing a black leather bustier that showed a lot of cleavage and black leather pants that displayed what had to be a painful camel toe. She draped the duster over my father's television chair on her way to the dining room.
Hey, how's it going? Joyce said. I saw the car parked in the driveway, and I said to myself, I bet that's Stephanie's car. So I thought I'd come in and see how she was doing.
Her eyes flicked to Ranger for a split second, and I was pretty sure I saw her nipples get hard behind the black leather. My father was frozen in his chair with his fork halfway to his mouth, and Elmer looked like he just filled his bag.
Give me your gun, I whispered to Ranger.
Ranger slid his arm across the back of my chair and leaned close.
Stay calm.
Nice house you've got here, Mrs. P, Joyce said. You obviously have a talent for decorating. I could tell that by the fabric choice on the slipcovers in the living room.
Grandma beamed at Joyce.
I've always said that. She's got a real eye for picking out just the right thing.
And you set an excellent table, too.
The secret is you gotta take the olives out of the jar and put them in a little bowl, Grandma said. If you notice, we put everything in a bowl. That's what makes the difference.
I'll try to remember that, Joyce said. Put everything in a bowl.
Grandma turned to my mom.
Isn't it nice to see such a polite young person? Almost no one appreciates things today.
My mother tried to refill her wine glass, but the bottle was empty.
Darn, my mother said.
We cooked up two big chickens, Grandma said to Joyce. You could stay for dinner if you want. We have plenty.
Are you sure it wouldn't be an imposition?
Joyce wedged a chair between Grandma and Elmer so she could look across the table at Ranger.
I wouldn't want to impose.
I'll get you a place setting, Grandma said, scraping back in her chair.
Eddie Haskell,
Ranger whispered against my ear, leaning into me.
What?
Joyce is doing Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver. Eddie Haskell was the obnoxious kid who was always sucking up to the Cleavers.
You watched Leave It to Beaver?
Hard to believe, but I didn't start out at age 30. I actually had a childhood.
Mind-boggling.
Sometimes it boggles even my mind, Ranger said.
What are you two whispering about? Joyce asked. And where's Morelli? I thought this was his gig.
Joe's working, I told her. Ranger volunteered to stand in. Joyce opened her mouth to say something, thought better of it, and forked up some chicken. I'm going to the kitchen to get some hot gravy, I told everyone.
Joyce, why don't you help me?
I closed the kitchen door behind us, nuked the gravy boat, and turned to Joyce.
What's going on?
I realized I was going about this wrong. We're both looking for Dickie, right? But you have Studman out there working with you.
That gives you a real advantage over me. So instead of forcing you to butt out, I'm gonna stick to you like glue. You and Studman will find Dickie for me.
Ranger won't turn Dickie over to you.
I'll worry about that when he finds him. Ranger's a man, and I know what to do with a man. You get them undressed, and they're all basically the same. Scrotum and ego. If you stroke them, they're happy. And I don't see you doing much stroking with Ranger. Looks to me like he's open season.
I took the gravy boat out of the microwave and carried it back to the table. Ranger's chair was empty. Where's Ranger? I asked Grandma. He said he had business to take care of, but he left you the keys to the car. They're by your plate. He said he'd catch up with you later.
I put the keys in my pocket, and I wondered about Ranger's needs. It wasn't as if I was fulfilling them, and it wasn't as if he was a low-testosterone kind of guy.
That's some outfit you got on, Elmer said to Joyce. I bet you put out.
Behave yourself, Joyce said. And you got a nice pair of melons there. Are they real?
Joyce smacked Elmer on the head, and his toupee flew off and landed on the table in front of my mother. My mother jumped in her seat and beat the toupee to death with the empty wine bottle. Oh, my God, my mother said, looking at the mangled hair. It startled me. I thought it was a giant spider. Elmer reached over and retrieved his hair and settled it back on his head.
This used to happen all the time at the home, too.
I made it through the chicken and the chocolate cake. I helped my mom clear the table and do the dishes, and that brought me up to 7:30. Gotta go, I said to my mom. Things to do.
Me too, Joyce said, following me to the door.
I couldn't have Joyce tail me to my meeting at the Marriott, so as I saw it, I had two options. The first option would be to handcuff her at gunpoint to a dining room chair. The second would be to lose her on the road. I decided to go with option two, mostly because I had the box of bullets in my purse, but no gun. Joyce was driving a black Mercedes sedan, which I was pretty sure represented husband number two. She got behind the wheel and gave me a thumbs up. I got into Ranger's Porsche and responded with a stiff middle finger. I drove off, and after a block, I realized Joyce wasn't following. I checked her out in my rearview mirror and saw that she was out of the car, looking under the hood. I turned around and pulled alongside her. What's up? I asked.
I don't know much about cars, Joyce said, but I think someone took my engine.
Chapter 8. I parked in the hotel garage and walked through the garage to the hotel. It was a few minutes before 8, and there was a corporate party going on in the ballroom. Lots of women in cocktail dresses and men in suits congregating in the public areas. Lots of drinking and laughing and flirting. I suspected in a couple hours some of it would get nasty. The bar was packed, but Smullen wasn't there. I found a chair in the lobby and waited. After a half hour, I did a tour of the bar and restaurant. Still no Smullen. I called Ranger at 9. I've been stood up, I told him.
Lucky you, Ranger said.
Did you take Joyce's engine?
My instructions were to disable the car, but one of my men bet Hal a burger he couldn't get the engine out, so Hal removed the engine.
I knew Hal. He'd been with Rangeman for a couple years, and he was one of my favorite people. He looked like Stegosaurus, and he fainted at the sight of blood. I left the hotel and walked past a few desperate souls hunkered in a corner by the entrance, trying to smoke without freezing their ass off. No one coming or going to the parking garage. Just me, my steps echoing on the cement floor. I approached the Cayenne, and Ranger moved out of a shadow.
I'll drive, he said. I want to make sure no one's waiting for you in your apartment.
I appreciate the thought, but I wasn't going home. I was going to hang out in the cemetery and see if Diggory relieves Lorraine Birnbaum of her diamond.
It's 17 degrees, Ranger said. If Diggory is desperate enough to rob graves in this weather, the least you can do is let him have the diamond.
Ranger crossed Broad and turned onto Hamilton. A dark figure scuttled from between parked cars, and quick as a flash, it scooped something off the road with a shovel. The figure was momentarily caught wide-eyed in Ranger's headlights. And then the figure was gone, sucked back between the parked cars, lost in the night. I gasped and did a whole body shiver.
Someone you know? Ranger asked.
Crazy Carl Coughlin. He's on my FTA list.
Babe.
If I was any kind of bounty hunter, I would have chased Coughlin down, but I really didn't want to see what was on the shovel. So I decided to go with Ranger's philosophy. If Coughlin needed roadkill that bad, the least I could do is let him keep it. 3 traffic lights later, Ranger cut off Hamilton and parked in my lot. He looked up at my dark apartment windows, shut the Cayenne down, and turned to face me.
Tell me about your kitchen discussion with Joyce.
She realized she would be helping me find Dickie and decided it was smarter to follow me around than to go off on her own. So, she's my new best friend. I told her I didn't think it was likely you turned Dickie over to her, and she said she had a way with men. She said men were basically scrotum and ego, and they were happy when they got stroked. Ranger reached across the console and traced a line down the side of my face. His fingertip was warm, and his touch was gentle.
I'd like to think I'm more than just scrotum and ego.
but she was right about the stroking. An SUV crept into the lot and parked behind us. Ranger looked back at it.
That's Tank. He's giving me a ride back to Rangeman after I check your apartment. I'll leave the Cayenne with you.
Caesar rang my bell precisely at 9 a.m. He was dressed in Rangeman black, and he was slimmer than most of Ranger's men. Caesar wouldn't single-handedly haul an engine out of a Mercedes. I placed him in his late 20s. He handed a tote bag plus winter jacket over to me and politely stepped into my apartment. I'll just be a minute, I told him. Make yourself at home. He nodded, but he remained standing just inside the door, hands folded in front of him. Parade rest. I'd worked for Rangeman once before, and Ranger's housekeeper Ella knew my size. She'd sent black leather cross trainers, black cargo pants, a long-sleeved black t-shirt with the Rangeman logo in magenta, and a black webbed canvas belt. The black winter jacket was identical to the one Ranger wore, with the logo in black. I got dressed and looked at myself in the mirror. I was Mini Ranger. I said goodbye to Rex, locked the apartment, and followed Caesar to an immaculate black Ford Explorer. No logo. Caesar drove to a large, rambling colonial north of town. The grounds were perfectly landscaped even in winter, and the house had a sweeping view of the river. We parked in the circular drive, Caesar took a clipboard from the back seat, and we went to work. The owners are off-site, Caesar said, keying us into the house. A vacation in Naples. We're installing a new security system while they're away. The husband does a lot of travel, and the wife stays home with two school-age children, so we need to make the system meet the wife's needs. Ranger thought you would be helpful since you see things from a woman's perspective. We did a fast tour of the house and then went through a second time more slowly, making notes. I didn't know anything about living in a house like this, and I didn't have experience as a mother, but I knew something about fear. And I've broken into enough houses to know what serves as a deterrent. In a house this size, I'd want to know if a door was opened. I'd want closed-circuit television on entrances. I'd want exterior security lighting. I'd want some mobile touchpads to give myself flexibility. I'd want to make sure the children's rooms were protected against intrusion. That would mean the screen should be wired into the alarm system. It was almost noon when Caesar dropped me at my apartment building. I ran upstairs, made myself a peanut butter and olive sandwich, and pawed through my junk drawer while I ate. My job as a bounty hunter heavily relies on my ability to stretch the truth and go into sneaky mode. I have patches and hats for almost any occasion, from pizza delivery to plumbing to security specialist. I found a patch that advertised Richter Security and used double-sided sticky tape to plaster the patch over the Rangeman logo on the black jacket. I dropped a travel flash drive into my pocket so I could record computer data, and I grabbed a clipboard and pad. It was Saturday, and I was guessing there would be a single security guard on front desk duty at Pediak, Smullen, Gorvich, and Orr. I hadn't learned anything from Dickie's house. I was hoping his files were intact at his office. I parked the Cayenne in the small lot adjacent to the building and sat there for a moment, gathering my courage. Truth is, I'm not all that brave, and I'm not all that good at what I do, and I was pretty close to getting nervous bowels. I was going to break into Dickie's office, and I was doing it because it wasn't nearly as frightening as the prospect of going to jail for a murder I didn't commit. Still, it was pretty damn frightening. I talked myself into getting out of the Cayenne, and I walked to the front of the building and let myself into the foyer. The large glass door leading to the law offices was locked, and just as I'd suspected, a security guard was behind the desk. I showed him my clipboard and pointed to my watch, and he came to the door. Richter Security, I told him, handing him a business card that went with the Richter Security logo on my jacket. I'm scheduled to come in and work up an estimate on a new system.
I don't know anything about that, he said. The offices are closed.
You were supposed to be notified. There must be someone you can call.
I've only got emergency numbers.
They specifically requested a Saturday so business wouldn't be disturbed. I moved a lot of jobs around so I could do this, and if I can't get in today, I don't have another Saturday opening until October. Now here's the good part. Men trust women. Even if I look like a $5 handjob hooker, this guy would think I was the real deal. Women grow up wary, and men grow up thinking they're immortal. Maybe that's overstated, but I'm in the ballpark.
Just exactly what are you supposed to do?
He asked. I guess everyone got a little freaked over the disappearance of one of the partners, and they decided to upgrade the security system. My specialty is video surveillance. I'll be designing an enhanced video system for use throughout the building. Obviously, this isn't something that can be done during business hours, No one wants to think their every action is being monitored.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. How long will this take?
An hour tops. I just need to draw some room diagrams. Are the partners' offices open?
Yeah, no point locking them. They're hardly used. Only Mr. Orr came in every day, and sometimes Mr. Smullen when he was in town.
That's weird. What kind of lawyer doesn't use his office?
Don't ask me. I'm just part-time. Maybe they're all a bunch of rich guys who don't need to work. They just like to have their name on the door. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I'm not rich like that, so I'd better get to work.
Holler if you need anything.
I started in Dickie's office. My original intent had been to get into his computer and search for a client list, but his computer was gone. That brought me to plan B, raid his file cabinet. I went through three drawers of files and understood nothing. Why can't lawyers write in English? I gave up on the files and sat at his desk. I opened the top drawer and found two file folders. One was labeled Nuts and Stalkers, and the other was labeled Current. Hooray, now I was getting somewhere. I shoved the folders into my pants under the waistband and buttoned my coat over them. Smullen's office was similar in design to Dickie's. Same furniture, but Smullen's desk drawers were filled with candy bars. Mounds, Baby Ruth's, M&M's, Snickers, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Twizzlers. His computer was fresh out of the box, software installed. Nothing else. No Rolodex. A pen and a pad, but nothing written. Coffee cup stains on his leather desktop from Starbucks. Nothing of interest in his file drawers. I snitched a couple Snickers and a Reese's and moved on to Gorvitch. His office was also unused. No candy bars in the drawers. Gorvitch's drawers were empty. Ditto Pettiak. C.J. Sloan had been printed in small block letters on the door to the office next to Pettiak's. I had no idea what Sloan did for the firm, but he obviously did it in his office because there were stacks of files on every flat surface. There were four in-out baskets on the desk, and they were all filled with papers. His computer monitor was extra wide. And while there was a lot of clutter in the office, it was all perfectly aligned. Sloan was a totally anal neat freak. I went into Sloan's computer and struck gold. Sloan had client lists with billable hours, current and past. I plugged my flash drive into a USB port and downloaded a bunch of files. In a last-ditch effort, when I left Sloan's office, I tried the secretary's desk. She had all the hardware, but not much content. Multi-line phone, super-duper computer, and a drawer filled with takeout menus. There was a small wooden crate, two cardboard boxes, and an industrial staple gun by the desk. Someone was packing. The elevator binged, and before I had time to react, a huge guy stepped out. He was dressed in shirt and tie and bad-fitting dark blue suit. He was late 20s, early 30s, and he lifted. Probably did some roids. His hair was buzzed short and bleached blonde. L.A. Muscle Man. Muscle Man approached the desk and looked down at me.
What you doing?
I had the Pizza Hut menu in my hand. Ordering out? Do you like pepperoni?
The loser downstairs said he let you up here to install televisions.
I was on my feet behind the desk. I'm doing the prelim on some security monitors.
No, you're not. I know who you are. I saw your picture in the paper. You're the nut who tried to choke Mr. Orr.
You're mistaken. I work for Richter Security. I guess I have a double out there somewhere, eh?
I don't make mistakes like that, lady. I got an eye for the girls. I can even remember your name. Stephanie Plum. I remember it because it's a hoe name. Stephanie Juicy. Stephanie Good to Eat. Stephanie, I'm gonna sink my teeth into you.
Yikes. Sorry, I told him. I'm not on the menu.
I think you are. I think I'm going to have some fun with you before I turn you over to Mr. Pettiak.
Is he your boss?
Yeah, and he don't like intruders. He's got things he does to them so they don't intrude anymore, but sometimes he lets me have fun with him first.
I had pepper spray and a stun gun in the bag. Let me show you my identification.
The only identification I care about is between your legs, Stephanie Juicy.
He was around the desk in two strides, reaching out for me. I knocked his hand away, grabbed the staple gun, pressed it into his crotch, and bam, 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 I stapled his nuts. At least I thought it felt like nuts, but hell, what do I know? There's other equipment down there, and I guess it could have been most anything. Muscle Man's mouth dropped open, and his face turned red. He froze for a moment, sucking air, and then he doubled over and crashed to the floor.
I was in love with the genius who invented the electric stapler.
I wasted no time getting out of there. I ran out of the office and flew down the stairs. I crossed the lobby and was out the front door before the guard at the desk was on his feet. I bolted for the lot and ran flat out into Ranger when I turned the corner. He absorbed the impact without moving and wrapped his arms around me to keep me from falling.
"We need to get out of here," I told him.
Tank was idling behind the Cayenne. Ranger signaled that he could leave, and Ranger and I got into the Porsche. Ranger drove out of the lot, made a U-turn half a block away, and parked.
"What were you doing in the lot?" I asked him.
"Hal was working the remote monitors and suspected you were in the law office building. He was worried about you."
"How about you? Were you worried about me?"
"I always worry about you."
"We didn't get anything out of Dickie's house," I told Ranger, "so I decided to look at his office. Didn't think there'd be much activity on a Saturday. Figured I could fly under the radar."
Ranger peeled the Richter security label off my jacket.
"And?"
"Dickie's office is a normal working office. It looked like everything was still intact, at least until I got there." I unbuttoned my jacket, removed the files, and handed them to Ranger. We were sitting there watching the building, and the big blonde goon stumbled out the front door. He was doubled over, holding himself. He inched his way to the lot, crawled into a silver Camry, and slowly drove down the street. Ranger looked over at me, eyebrows raised in question. "It turned out I wasn't entirely under the radar," I told Ranger. "And I had to staple his nuts."
"Babe."
"He said he worked for Pediac. I'm not sure what he was doing there on a Saturday because the desk guard said Pediac never comes into the office, and Pediac's office looked unused. For that matter, all the partners' offices looked unused, excluding Dickie's." Ranger skimmed the current folder.
"These are all one-page summaries for quick reference, and at first glance, they all look like normal low-grade law. A couple property damage cases, a criminal case against Norman Wolecki for assault, litigation against a landscaper, more property damage. I could be missing something, but it doesn't look to me like any of these cases would bring in big money."
"So we have three partners with empty file cabinets, a fourth partner who chased ambulances, $40 million withdrawn from a Smith Barney account, a dead accountant, and a missing Dickie."
"I talked to Zip about his brother. He said Ziggy did high-volume accounts. He was under the impression Pediac, Small and Gorvitch, and Orr represented power."
"Apparently not Dickie. Dickie represented Norman Wolecki." Ranger looked at the second folder.
"Nuts and